Hey, who's this? Oh, I'm Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien. I'm usually behind the scenes, but I'm here to tell you that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we're listening back to an episode from June on millennials and work. Millennials make up the largest portion of American workers. About 35% of the country's workforce is part of the millennial generation. That's people born between 1982 and 1996. So the oldest are in their early 40s, and the youngest are hitting their late 20s. We're going to look at the particular brand of career crisis that many millennials seem to be going through, particularly post-pandemic. Today's show is a rebroadcast, so we won't be taking any new calls or emails. Our first guest this hour is Allison Sprinkle. She's a career coach based in Burlington. Our conversation begins with Allison sharing with us the story of her own career path.
Pre-pandemic, I was a server in Burlington, and for most of my adult, like, professional life, I was a server, and I was very good at it. I loved it. I love people and building community. I worked, the last serving job I had was at the Farmhouse Tap and Grill in Burlington, right on Bank Street, and I worked there for 9 years, and I really got to know people really well, and it was a great job. And then the pandemic happened, and I started a kind of side gig while waiting tables called Pepperly CBD. Mm-hmm. And with that, it's like a handmade bath, beauty, and wellness collection all infused with organic Vermont-grown hemp. So that was my side gig, and I got into the Burlington Farmers Market with that the first year that I started, which was 2019. Mm. So then 2020 hit, and the pandemic, and we were all kind of called off of work, and my kind of side gig part-time passion project now became my full-time thing, which was really beautiful. And, you know, you hold on to these quote-unquote safe jobs like the waiting tables or then the sure thing paycheck, and then all of a sudden the world got flipped upside down, and now my side gig, which I thought would be nothing, turned into my full-time income. So the Burlington and Stowe Farmers Markets, I was doing those, and then, you know, increasing my visibility on Instagram and just through the farmers markets every year, more and more people would follow me and really came to love my products. And then within the past couple of years, people started coming to me for business advice. And I had hired coaches in the past. I have some really great coaches that have helped me kind of short track my path to success.
So is that why people, I don't want you to short shrift yourself
because
no one's coming to me for business advice. So what do you think you were putting out there that made people say like, hey, you know, this friend or this person I know could give me some good advice?
Yeah, I think it's how I showed up on social media and shared my story every step of the way. And people really like to see, like, at least in Vermont, I feel like people want to see you win. Like your community that you build around your brand, like, and especially I think because I went from like waiting tables to having a successful business, like people were psyched for me about that.
Yeah.
And just were like, well, Allison did it. So, you know, and I'm kind of like the everyman in that situation, right? So I think it just helped other people see that like she can get out of waiting tables. Maybe I can too. The coaching business just felt like a really natural offshoot of Pepper Lee. Like I just kind of distilled the wisdom that I had learned and kind of broke it down into a program and help other people get their life.
So tell us more about what it means to be a career coach, particularly for someone who, is familiar with going to a therapist for support, might be familiar with the idea of a life coach. What does a career coach do?
Yeah, a career coach for me, I guess I can only speak to what I do, but I think there's a few different avenues you can take. But I really help my clients kind of build daily habits around their life, and I just put up like a scaffolding around them with like accountability and health in mind and a lot of other facets of life, like we're only as well, like our business is only as well as we are. So I really do take into account other aspects of life besides just the career part, which is a huge part of what we do. But I think once people feel like safe in their lives, then they can then create from there. So we focus on all the pillars of self, like relationships to substances comes up sometimes and like love comes up sometimes. But the main focus would be the main kind of end goal is that we have this like successful business. So we'll build some habits around getting us to that place and how to use social media and how to, you know, build a website and establish an LLC and all those things come as well. Mm.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Allison Sprinkle, a career coach based in Burlington. And ahead of today's show, we posted on Instagram asking for folks' thoughts on this topic of, you know, having that moment in your career, particularly if you're a millennial, maybe you're kind of hitting that mid-career moment and you're wondering, do I have the right work-life balance? Am I doing work that, you know, can support my life and also feels meaningful? And we got a lot of responses that we'll be sharing throughout the show today. One person on Instagram writes, I left a career in science and now I own my own business. Another person writes, I'm actually quite confident of my identity outside of my job. I just can't figure one out inside a job. And Allison, that's what I wanted to ask you about, that feeling of knowing who you are, feeling confident in your personal life, maybe with your hobbies, with your family and friends, but then you go to work and you feel lost.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of what the Great Resignation is all about. Like we had time to rest and really look within and during COVID, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, wait, this career path or this thing that I'm spending a majority of my life on really isn't something that lights me up inside. So like, let me just look around and see if there's something I can somehow turn into a way to provide myself employment instead of going and working on someone else's dreams. I'm going to work on my own.
Mm. How often do you find yourself recommending that somebody follow a path in some ways that's similar to what you did, where you had that job where you're making a steady income, you can rely on it, and you start to develop a business on the side. In some ways, that feels like a great way to do things. You know, you're keeping money coming in while you're seeing if something else works, yeah. But it also could probably lead to some burnout.
I think if the end goal is to leave your full-time employment, then I think there is a point where it becomes like you can't afford to do both, or you can't afford to not do the thing that is your passion project, that is your side thing. Like there will become a point where it's more lucrative and more fulfilling to do that side project and you do have to eventually leave, which is the whole point, right?
Right. Could you share some moments from your own work with career coaches that felt like they gave you a path forward or a kind of a spark of inspiration?
Yeah, this is kind of a super personal one, but I think it's important. One of my career coaches, Chrissy Leonard, she had me do this income tracker, which was very like numbers, and I'm not a numbers person. Like I like balked at this exercise for a really long time, but then she was like, okay, we're going to do it in the call because you keep putting it off and we're just going to do it while we're talking.
Is that accountability?
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, okay, let's just do it. And I looked at it and we added up, like it was like a spreadsheet, and we added up all the numbers. And I was like, oh my gosh, I make enough money to like leave my relationship and support myself. And that was not only the spark that like changed my life, but it also helped change my life in a way that was like, I want to help other people do this.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking, did that moment lead to you, in fact, leaving a relationship? Or was it more about just like realizing that you could support yourself on your own?
Yeah, no, I left that relationship, and like no shade to that person. It was just like the time of that relationship was over, but I kept using finances as an excuse. Mm. And then, you know, the numbers don't lie. Like if you can afford to support yourself, like if that's the only crutch that you have left, like she kind of like took that excuse down and really helped me, you know. So that's like business and life, right? So that was like a huge, obviously a huge thing that really changed my life.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Sorry if that's like too personal.
Oh, no. I mean, we love personal on Vermont Edition. How often, you mentioned using finances as an excuse. What are some of the other like quote unquote excuses that you find yourself like working with your clients on to maybe let go of?
Yeah. We kind of in the coachy world call it resistance. Mm. And it's really anything that like takes you out of your power or like makes you want to divert from the path of your higher self. So it could look like scrolling on your phone or, you know, just wasting time doing other things or putting your household chores first or anything like that. Like, so we just try to kind of put that in the box of like resistance. And that's kind of like taking you out and away from your major goals. And really that's, we just want to like bypass that and kind of reframe it and be like, nope, that's okay. Forgive yourself, but like move on. We're going to hop over that thing.
Yeah. And Allison, we sort of framed this show as focusing on one specific generation, millennials, which you and I don't know how old you are. I'm
assuming. Actually born in 82, so I like just
you're
made
right
it.
In there, elder.
Yeah, I'm an elder millennial.
Well, so we're both in that generation. How much of this, like, I don't know, there was so much talk about the Great Resignation and kind of mid-career people who are typically millennials reevaluating work. How much of this do you think is unique to this generation versus something that happens cyclically?
Yeah, I think that. I think it happens cyclically.
Number two.
And I think, yeah, I think every generation kind of defines work a little bit differently based on the, you know, the zeitgeist. So we just had the pandemic. No generation since 1919 has had something like that. So I'd be interested to see what worked look like post 1919, although that wouldn't really be great because there were no real women in the workforce at that time. So maybe that wouldn't even be data that would be usable. But I think, the times kind of designate the way work looks, you know.
Yeah. I want to share a couple other responses on Instagram that we received. One person writes, I graduated with my MFA in 2020 and didn't get to full work in my field until years later. Another person writes, I just left my job after 17 years of teaching because post-pandemic, it is a terribly hard job. And a third person writes, I don't feel my career is a pillar of who I am or what defines me. It's my job, not my identity. Allison, let's go back to that person who wrote post-pandemic, they felt like their job had gotten a lot harder. We definitely heard that from a lot of teachers and folks in many other careers. Do you think...
Restaurant workers, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. What are some of the other industries where, or do you think it's kind of everyone that's feeling like after the pandemic, things are just kind of permanently different now?
Yeah, I was just having a talk with my boyfriend last night about how just like post-pandemic, everything's closed on Monday. Like nothing is open.
I thought that was just a Vermont thing.
No, I think it's like pretty, well, maybe it is just a Vermont thing, but I don't know. Post-pandemic, everything's closed in Vermont. I don't know. I think the industries that were most affected are the ones that are public facing, right? So the hospitals and the restaurants and things like that. But I think it really was so good for restaurant workers to have that time off. It's such a mentally and physically draining job that I think a lot of what we're seeing in the Great Resignation was restaurant workers.
Mm. Interesting. But I don't know, what you're bringing up kind of points to this, this like privilege that maybe we should acknowledge about like the ability to step back and take time off. Mm-hmm. Like I hear you on the point that like a lot of restaurant workers probably really needed that space, and some of them, you know, thrived and found new passions in it, and others were, you know, desperate for income that they lost. I don't know. I wonder what your thoughts are there on like the kind of built-in privilege maybe to being able to rethink career.
Oh, for sure. There's definitely, I mean, some people did not get a break, but then that also kind of short tracks the path to burnout, like nurses rethinking their lives. Like, either way, whether you had the time to rest or your business, like your professional life, got turned way up and became unbearable, I think both of those things, one was probably a little more pleasant way to do it. Mm-hmm. But both of those instances is going to cause you to rethink how you do your work in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's take a call before we have to go to break. We have Catherine in Vergennes. Catherine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that I'm currently 43, and I never felt like I had any career per se. You know, I started in one area, and then I moved across the country and picked up bits of work here and there, and it was never sustainable. And so I started my own company just about 2 years ago. I can't say that I'm making enough to really support myself completely without a W-2 job yet, but it's really different in some very nice ways, even if you're not making enough to completely support your own lifestyle.
Mm. Well, Catherine, thank you for sharing your work story with us. Is that, I don't know, something that resonates with you, Allison?
Oh my gosh, everything that Catherine said, definitely. I mean, we're even like a similar age and everything. So yeah, creating employment for yourself. And I also didn't, I was a server and I was, you know, I was approaching 40 and I was like, is this really like, not that there's anything wrong with being a server, but it's really hard on your body. And I wanted to find something else. And so it took me starting my own thing, just like her, you know? So it really is such a beautiful thing to be able to create employment for yourself and support yourself. And don't give up, Catherine.
You got this, Catherine.
Call me.
Today, we're listening back to an episode on the relationship between millennials and work. Our guests are Allison Sprinkle, a career coach based in Burlington, and Sarah King. She's a musician in Ripton. Also, a reminder that today's show is a rebroadcast from June, so we're not taking any new calls or emails. Let's jump back into our conversation with Sarah describing her music career. We'll play a short clip from her song, Not Worth the Whiskey.
And I can only be good for so long. You've done me so wrong. You're not worth the whiskey.
Oh, the whistling. I love it, Sarah. It's so good. It's so good. Well, we're so glad that you could join us for this conversation. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a full-time musician? How did that happen?
Yeah, I have sort of a similar story. It was definitely during the pandemic when I had time to kind of sit down and do that same thing where I was like, man, is this really what I want to do with my life? Or am I really being called to music? I've been a musician my whole life, but I've never really focused on it as a career. And then just, yeah, a few things kind of lined up at the start of the pandemic when nothing was real and time didn't matter. And that was when I started to think, maybe it's time. Maybe I can actually make this work. You know, it doesn't just have to be a hobby. I'm always coming back to it. And, you know, I was in a music marketing webinar and somebody said the phrase leap and the net will appear. Mm. And that has been kind of my guiding principle since then. Just taking these risks to make it happen because, yeah, I mean, as millennials, like, we're not getting any younger and the time is now. Life is short. There's been a lot of reminders about that lately. And took a few big risks that seem to be paying off and hopefully will continue to do so. And that has led me here.
Mm. Well, what were some of the difficulties that you had balancing your previous day job with music that led you to decide to take these big leaps?
Yeah, there were kind of a lot. Of course, once I started touring and playing in places that were a bit further away, you know, I'd have to leave work early and make sure that I took days off or scheduled things like that. So that was like a little, you know, a mini thing that kind of made it difficult to balance. Also difficult as an independent musician. So when I was working full time and then trying to have time to write songs and practice, and then also like booking shows and finding opportunities. It was just, it was so much that it was, you know, I would hardly practice because I had no time. And as the performances and that side was getting better, I was able to finally dial down my day job to being part-time and then music. And then, yeah, mid-pandemic, there are a couple of conferences and events that occur annually, different times of the year. And they all kept lining up with times at work that were like, these are our busy weeks, everyone, all hands on deck. And there was one day when my partner was like, maybe that's a sign, because you have to keep skipping all these conferences because you have to be at work. And, you know, it's not helping you get further as a musician. And so I quit.
Wow. And what were those first few months like?
The first few months were awesome. I was totally prepped. I got like a big tax return right around the same time. I had a nice big tour booked. You know, I just did a lot of really awesome stuff. It was great. I was so proud of myself. And then after those first couple of months, it was January and winter in Vermont is tough anyway. And then I had some health issues. Then like my piano died and then like the bills started piling up. And so it was like the highest of highs to the lowest of lows within 6 months. That was really stressful.
Mm. Allison, I see you nodding. Is that a cycle that you've heard folks go through before?
Oh yeah. I call it the dip.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us more. What should people expect?
I mean, that's really something that a career coach, like we all see that so much. Like you get, you know, you have like the less experience you have, the more like bravado you have. And then once time goes on and things don't start working out, you start to dip down into this self-doubt and, you know, you hit a few bumps and then you're like, what am I doing? Da, da, da. But then if you can really ride that low out, it does come back up.
Mm. Is that what you try to encourage people to do, to ride that low?
That's my job.
And Sarah, is that something that you felt like you had to push through as well, or that you were successfully able to push through?
Yeah, I had to be more vulnerable than I had been in the past. So I was very open with like my fan base and telling people like, oh my goodness, like I am struggling here. You know, I took this big leap and like is the net still being woven? Like, is that what's going on? And so people stepped up and like some fans sent me donations to help cover the cost of the piano and stuff so that way I could handle my medical bills. And then I just kept moving forward. I healed up, everything went well. And then last summer I was back out on the road again. So I think also in my industry, being a musician, some of it is a bit seasonal, cyclical. They're always, my busy season is the summertime. And so long Vermont winters plus a slowdown in live performances is just a cyclical thing that I have to get used to. It doesn't mean the world is ending. If I'm not doing a whole bunch of stuff in January, I'm going to get through it. And by the time we get to this time of year, everything's usually pretty busy.
Hmm. Allison, do you have advice for folks who might also be entering into a new career that feels cyclical, like the one that Sarah is describing?
Yeah, I'm a farmer's market vendor. That was my first thing. So that's also very, very cyclical. So just bolstering yourself a little bit and like while the sun's shining and you're making hay, just tuck a little away for sure. Be prepared for the taxes and for those dips and just anticipate it and know that like the sun will shine again. It will be April, May, June again. Like everything will really come around for you. And just the more time you get behind it and the more wisdom you have around it, and maybe get a little creative. Like if there's like a few winter weddings or your friends are getting married, like maybe they want you to play their wedding or, you know, something like that. Like there's always some way, as long as, I mean, it sounds like Sarah, it sounds like you have an amazing community. So, and you've already gotten creative with it, but that's part of like a business coach's thing too, is just to brainstorm your individualized particular situation and help you weather those storms a little bit and come up with some fun ideas on how to generate some cash.
Love that. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Harry in Cornish, New Hampshire. Harry, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, because I'm in the woods here. I feel really bad for young people today, actually, because I'm 59, and the pressure that young people have today to kind of make it is extraordinary. And I think it's because of social media. They see people on TikTok, and nowadays young people are able to see their peers making it early. But, you know, I didn't make it as a cartoonist until I was 35. And prior to that, I was a waiter for, I was a busboy, I was a maitre d', I was a bartender, I was on welfare. You know, and not once through all of those years did I think to myself, you know, I'm not going to make it. I gotta quit, you know, because I just head down and I continued to work on my craft. And I didn't think about money. I didn't care about success. I just loved what I was doing. And I figured at a certain point, the work is going to be so good that people won't ignore it. But that takes years. And like I said, I'm curious what your guests think about the impact on social media and that pressure that it puts on young people to make it. It seems counterproductive and in some ways counterintuitive to making great art.
Well, Harry, thank you so much for calling. I know who you are, and you certainly have made it. I love your cartoons. And we're just in just a couple of minutes, actually, we're going to be hearing from another cartoonist who has also been wrestling with this idea of work. So it's a perfect tie-in. Thank you for the transition, Harry. Allison, what do you think of what Harry just said?
Did we just have a Vermont celebrity call in?
Well, technically New Hampshire celebrity, but at this moment. But yes, we did.
That was awesome. Yeah, I really think putting your head down and just keeping your eye on the prize and continuing to hone your craft is really the path to success. And whether it looks like someone's an overnight success or not, we're really on social media just sharing our highlight reel, and all the ugly stuff happens behind the scenes, whether it takes 20 years or 2 years. I think social media also shortens the path to success because we can share our story and our work in a more global way. And I'm sure Sarah has found that too with her music.
Yeah, Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, social media definitely changed the landscape for music because we can now share directly to fans, which is great, but it's also a ton of pressure. He's totally right. Like, because I can look at people that I know, my peers in the industry, and yeah, I look at their highlight reel and I'm like, oh my goodness, what am I doing wrong? But I know that it goes both ways, you know, and if I'm sharing my highlight reel, someone's going to look at my stuff and be like, oh man, like, what is she doing right that I'm doing wrong? It definitely makes things feel like more competitive, and you feel like you've got to keep up with everybody. It's harder to like focus on your own journey. Like, I mean, when I was a kid, I was like, you know, always like out in the woods and very much by myself, and I would just follow my own path. And now, yeah, I mean, you have to be on social media to kind of be relevant. And yeah, just seeing what everybody else is up to can create an enormous amount of pressure. But he's also right. We've got to step back and focus on what we're doing and just be the best at what you're doing. And then they can't ignore you forever. And so finding that balance of, yes, I'm here on social media, but it doesn't define me, and I don't have to use it to like compete or try to keep up with somebody, but just to share my art or my business or whatever I'm doing. But it is definitely a challenge that I think, yeah, is new and unique. 30 years ago, it wasn't an issue, you know. I mean, obviously I was a kid too, but like, you know, well, I don't think it was the same for independent small business owners, creatives, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we call that compare and despair. When you look at someone and you're like, oh, they already have it. And, you know, I always like to tell my clients to like reframe that and try to use it as a lesson to like be patient and also like give those people their props and don't hate, like love on that person and be happy for them.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I think we all need to hear that, you know, because compare and despair, it's very close to home from guessing a lot of us on social media. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for this conversation today. Allison Sprinkle, a career coach in Burlington, thank you so much for joining us today.
This has been an absolute blast. I'm so glad I came. Thank you so much.
Yes, we'll have you back on soon when all the career questions start rolling in after show.
I'll be back.
And Sarah King, a Ripton-based musician, thank you so much for joining us. And if you're in the area, folks, you should check out her shows this summer. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'll just share a couple more quick posts from Instagram that we received about this show. One person writes, I felt adrift at the beginning of the pandemic at home with my kids. I moved to Vermont and I found my purpose. Another person writes, I was a baker for 10 years and left to work in the administration at my child's school. It was the best decision. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to a show from June about millennials and work. During that conversation, we spoke with Izzy Manley. She's a graduate of the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. She's also the author of a nonfiction comic called No One Wants to Work Anymore. The conversation begins with Izzy talking about the thesis of her book.
So this collection of comics, which just came out with a small press in New Orleans called Antenna Press, is four comics all about different experiences related to work during the pandemic. So some of the comics are a lot more personal about working in the service industry right at the beginning of the pandemic and navigating that scary situation that was constantly changing, navigating unemployment. One of the comics is about trying to apply for new jobs during the labor shortage. And then my favorite comic is interviews with other people about a huge variety of experiences with pandemic unemployment or changing working conditions. And I think the art style kind of changes from comic to comic, but they're all in color. And I think the thesis would just be kind of creating some space to examine the way that people's relationship to work has changed, and also this kind of liberating experience of being able to say that your job isn't necessarily the most meaningful thing in your life, or being able to question why have we built society in the way that we all have to work at bare minimum 40, but for most of us, a lot more hours a week just to survive.
How much of that do you see as a generational difference? I'm thinking of the many of us, myself included, who watched one or both parents work incredibly hard at a job, often at the same company, for decades, to kind of help their children get to a solid financial footing. And then, you know, our generation, this millennial generation, seems to be thinking like, oh, like that actually doesn't seem like maybe the best path forward.
Yeah, I think it definitely is a generational experience in the sense that I think work is only becoming more precarious. So many more of us are freelancers or gig workers. So many of us have lost rights to unionize or labor protections in different states. You know, during the pandemic, both of my parents had a lot of insecurity around their work and were on unemployment and off unemployment. And I think that it's something I'm seeing some older people experiencing as well. And so I think maybe 30 years ago, there was a little bit more of an opportunity to have a job that at some level was sustainable. And then I think so many more people are experiencing precarity across the different kinds of jobs, whether they're, you know, really low wage exploitative jobs or freelance jobs. Everything just feels so uncertain and unstable. I think even older people are experiencing that level of frustration as well.
During the early days of the pandemic, you were working in the service industry and you've made comics about that experience. Can you kind of describe, you know, from your vantage point now, how you look back on that time in your life?
I've always worked in the service industry or in teaching. And I think those are kind of similar kinds of jobs in that they're very demanding, they're very fast paced, you're on your feet all day. I think thinking specifically about working in the service industry at the beginning of the pandemic, it was really, really frightening because we knew so little about how to prevent spread and how to protect ourselves and protect each other. And I think Personally, I was kind of frustrated by some of the rhetoric around frontline workers as heroes and praising frontline workers because, you know, there were some jobs that were absolutely necessary and those workers, like in healthcare, deserve to be treated a lot better and to be protected more. But working in a restaurant, in a lot of ways, you would think, oh, is this really necessary? Is this really worth the risk at the time that I'm bringing on myself and bringing on the customers to provide a non-essential service?
Oh, you you got an MFA from the Center for Cartoon Studies in Vermont. How did getting an MFA after working for a while change your relationship with labor?
I think it was really wonderful to be a student again. And I came into an MFA program from teaching, specifically being an art teacher. And I don't necessarily think everyone should do an MFA, but I really think all working people deserve that experience to be able to like have time to think and process and learn something new and find a different side of themselves or discover something else they love to do or something else they're good at. But I think the flip side of that was also being burdened with student loans and then juggling being a full-time student on top of having a nearly full-time job also kind of heightened some of the realities around labor and money for me, and kind of made me think a lot about like, what does it mean to try to be an artist if you have to have a full-time job, and how do people manage that, and what are the conditions that allow us to be creative?
So what are your ideal conditions for creative work?
I think comics is interesting because it's kind of a notoriously laborious medium. You, depending on the cartoonist process, you're writing things out, you're drawing thumbnail sketches, you're inking things either with traditional materials or digitally. So it just takes a really, really long time. When I think back to the pandemic and I think about all the people who I knew who were on the supplemental unemployment benefit and were getting suddenly a living wage under really horrific conditions, but it was the first time they were able to stay home and explore this other side of themselves. And for a lot of people that did mean they started pursuing creative work that they hadn't had time for previously. And so I think something that would be really wonderful about a world where people had living wages and didn't have to devote so much of their time to work would mean that a lot more people had time to be creative in the ways that they wanted to. And so I just think, you know, if we ended up with a 4-3-day work week, I think those would be pretty amazing conditions for creative work.
I'm here for it. We've done a whole show about the 4-day work week, and let me tell you, people are into it. It might be time. Now, you live in Louisiana, and while there's obviously many, many differences between Vermont and Louisiana, you told our producer that you've noticed a bunch of similarities too. Could you tell us about that and maybe how those similarities connect with this conversation about labor?
The part of Louisiana I live in, New Orleans, the economy here is really focused on tourism. And living in Vermont, specifically working in the service industry, tourism during especially the fall season was where a lot of our business came from. So that can make labor conditions pretty difficult if there are limited industries. And then, you know, if you're reliant on an industry like tourism to bring money and resources into your community, when something like the pandemic happens, that is really devastating because those industries immediately shut down. And I think it's also hard to feel like we all want meaning and purpose in our work. And I think sometimes hospitality work can be really meaningful, but sometimes you can also feel like you're giving a lot of energy and labor not directly to your community. So I think just the similarity of, working in a tourist economy can make labor conditions pretty challenging.
Izzy, I'm wondering if you can describe for us what your dream work-life balance would be, what that setup would look like. Seems like a lot of folks right now are trying to kind of dream up their ideal in the hopes of one day, crafting that situation for themselves. What do you envision?
I love that question, and I think that's such a beautiful thing to ask people. I think I mentioned earlier that in my day job, I'm a teacher, and I do love teaching. I teach elementary age children art, but it's also such an exhausting job. And I would love to continue doing that, but 3 days a week, and then spend 2 or 3 days a week on making comics. And then also volunteering and doing other things in my community. I think I've never been a full-time cartoonist, but I know a lot of full-time cartoonists, and being a full-time artist isn't necessarily always a dream job, because you might be alone in your studio or in your house for 10 hours a day. And I think that can be really difficult as well when you don't have those opportunities to like be in community with people and be working in a different way and connecting with people and not just sitting at your desk. So for me, I think the dream situation is really getting to do both, getting to do art making, teaching, or some other community focused work, but in a way that felt sustainable and didn't deplete me too much.
How close do you think you are to that goal?
I don't think I'm close at all. I think the real tricky thing is, our public services. Like, for that to be a reality, you need good wages, but you also need nationalized healthcare and rent control. And I think I grew up in England, where we had some of those things, not to the degree that we should have. And I've lived in a lot of different places in the United States. Unfortunately, I think for the vast majority of us, until we have better support from the government, I think it'll be really hard to achieve that work, creativity, life, community balance in a sustainable way that you could continue for your whole life and not just try out maybe when you're young, but then eventually you need to like get back into a job that gives you stable health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Izzy, let us try to help you further your goals. Where can we find your work?
Online, I put updates about my work on my Instagram, which is at Izzy, @Izzy_MMMM. And my book is currently available from Antenna New Orleans. So if you're interested, you can order No One Wants to Work Anymore from Antenna New Orleans.
That was Izzy Manley, a graduate of the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction. We're going to wrap up this hour with something special for Thanksgiving. It's a conversation that was recorded through StoryCorps' Great Thanksgiving Listen project. The Great Listen encourages young people, and, well, people of all ages, to create an oral history of our times by recording an interview with an elder, mentor, friend, or someone they admire. Participants can record an interview with someone in the same room using the free StoryCorps app, or you can record with someone in a different location with a remote recording platform called StoryCorps Connect. As you gather with friends and family this Thanksgiving, it's a great time to capture these conversations for the StoryCorps archive. You can find out more at our website, vermontpublic.org. Let's take a listen to one now from Mary Othella Burnett, telling her daughter, Deborah Hamilton Palmer, about Granny Hayden, a second-generation midwife in Black Appalachia.
What was your relationship with her like, Mom?
She delivered me. She used to tell me how I startled her and my dad a few minutes after I was born by opening my eyes and turning my head to look around the room. And she said, "God, look at that." My grandmother loved to talk, and most of her stories were bad. But Granny's stories were real life stories. She didn't know anything about Hansel and Gretel. Here was this woman, a former slave, walking around, delivering babies and helping people. You have to understand that back when Granny started, there were no hospitals for Black people to go to, and poor people had no money to pay for professional medical care. So if you had a disease that could not be treated by a midwife, you died at home. Houses could be several miles apart, and bears commonly roved the neighborhoods, but she walked. If somebody needed help, Granny was going. Black and whites alike, it made no difference to her. She was fearless. You know, she never boasted about what she did, but she probably caught several hundred babies, if not more.
How old was Granny Hayden when she stopped her practice?
She was about 90 years old. She was a very strong little woman. You know, when people think about slavery, they think about hundreds of years ago, not about somebody who died in 1956. She was a pillar, not only in our family, but in our community. And I assumed she would always be there, like when you're a child. You assume everything's going to be there. But I'm very proud to have descended from someone like my grandmother. Very, very proud.
Those were the voices of Mary Othella Burnett and Deborah Hamilton Palmer from a StoryCorps recording as part of the Great Thanksgiving Listen. You can find out more at our website, vermontpublic.org. And some exciting news to share with you. As part of its cross-country mobile booth tour, StoryCorps is coming back to Vermont next summer. The mobile booth is an Airstream trailer outfitted with a recording studio. It'll visit Brattleboro and the Northeast Kingdom between July 5th and August 2nd, 2024, to collect stories from Vermonters like you. All right, that is it for today's Vermont Edition. We'll be back after Thanksgiving with more live, local Vermont Edition for you. Our show is produced by Tedra Meyer, Andrea Lorien, and Daniela Fierro. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.